I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In a breakthrough with profound medical and many say ethical implications, scientists in South Korea have cloned human embryos, extracting from them stem cells, which can potentially replace tissue damaged by disease and potentially be used to grow an entire human being, a clone. Doctors at Seoul National University say their goal is not to clone humans, but to advance toward the dream of cures for Parkinson's disease and diabetes and even paralysis. Joining us on the line is Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, the findings appear in Science magazine tomorrow, amounting to what some are literally calling a cookbook for cloning. As best you can in layman's terms, what did the South Koreans do that's never been done before?
Well, you know, you hear all kinds of claims of people saying they've made clone babies or they've got a cloned human embryo in a dish. In this case, this is the first peer-reviewed study that says, we've made a cloned embryo. Here's how we did it. We also grew that embryo for about 10 days and managed to find a stem cell. That's the part of the embryo that, if left inside a woman, would become the body of a fetus. And been able to make cells from that stem cell. So they've developed an embryo by dolly-style cloning, grown it in a dish, verified that it's truly a cloned embryo, and then found a stem cell and grown some cells from that. So they're a long way from being able to cure anybody or make anybody better, but this is the first reliable report that says, you know what, human cloning just might be possible.
Now, you say a long way for listeners with family suffering from diseases like Parkinson's, diabetes, paralysis. Are we talking a generation, Professor, or 5 years? Or
I'll tell you why it's hard to say anything more than 10 years, and it's not so hard to understand. Here we've got the first reliable report, trustworthy report, that somebody's cloned a human embryo. If you're going to get cures, you've got to take those embryos, put chemicals on them in dishes, and make them produce the cells that you might need. Let's say you had a damaged spinal cord. You've got to convince the little embryo stem cells to become just spinal cord cells.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to make a lot of those cells in that dish and make sure they're all the right kind. You don't want to be transplanting the wrong thing into somebody's body. Then you've got to get them out of the dish and into somebody's body and make sure they go there and work properly. That must be 4 steps in the dish, a lot of cells, transplant them, and make sure they stay in the recipient and work right. We're at step 1. We just figured out how to clone a human embryo.
Now,
so this is like the Wright brothers saying, you know what, flight's possible, but we're not ready to climb on a jumbo jet yet.
Good way to put it. Now, there will be fringe groups. We know there are fringe groups who are going to look at this so-called cookbook, and can they use it to clone a human being, or is that still in the realm of science fiction?
Well, they could. The instructions, if you will, what the techniques are right there in the paper. At the same time, remember, this team tried 250 times to get the one embryo they made. I would tell you that that's long odds in terms of trying to pull this off. Now, if you want to try and clone a human being, you'd have to get eggs, 250 of them, from different women who'd allow you to use their eggs to make a person, let's say. You'd have to do the transfers of the DNA and then put those embryos back into 250 women. So it's unlikely that this is going to be a secret project, and it's very likely that out of those 250 women, you'd have a lot of stillborn babies, sick babies, if you were lucky enough to get one baby. So could they do it? Yeah. Is it likely to work? Hardly.
Professor Kaplan, thanks for the perspective. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Arthur Kaplan is a professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania.
The Justice Department has gone to court to obtain hospital medical records to find out why late-term abortions have been performed. The procedures, called partial birth abortions by opponents, are now illegal under a new federal law, but that law has been appealed by doctors and abortion rights advocates, in part on the grounds of the health of the woman patient. And the Justice Department says it needs past medical records to fight that appeal. The University of Michigan Medical Center in Ann Arbor is one of the hospitals under subpoena. Spokesperson Kara Gavin says the medical center has so far refused to release records, but may have to if a judge orders patients' information to be blocked out.
if that court order does indeed come and if we're able to comply with it under privacy laws, we will then do a search to find if there are any medical records that might meet what the order is asking for. And at that time, if there are, we would then turn those over.
Well, joining us on the line is Daniel Solov. He teaches law at Seton Hall Law School in New Jersey. And, Professor, this is very complicated. A New York judge has ruled the hospital there must turn over the records. A Chicago judge has thrown out the Justice Department subpoenas. This feels like very new legal frontier.
Absolutely. This is something that has started to develop in the recent years as the government has started to try to get medical records with a mere subpoena, basically just a request for the records from the other side.
Yes, because the women whose records they may be are not even a part of the case.
That's correct.
Yeah. Now, the Justice Department is saying that there's no common federal medical privacy law, and the patients no longer expect complete confidentiality of their records. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely true. There is a federal patient-physician privilege that's in federal evidence law. And in addition, the privacy of patients and with their physicians is also protected by state law, which has numerous protections for safeguarding the confidentiality of patient information. Mm. For instance, patients can sue physicians if they disclose their confidential information in many states in this nation.
What about the new medical privacy law, the so-called HIPAA, H-I-P-A-A? Would that protect patients?
That provides limited protection because there's a provision that allows the government to obtain records with a subpoena for a law enforcement purpose. But that provision actually might not help the government in these cases because first it's limited to a law enforcement purpose, and these are civil cases in which this information is being required. However, HIPAA does seemingly leave open the possibility for them to get that information with if the identifying information for the patients is taken out.
We should say the Justice Department did not return a call from Here and Now before airtime, but they have said they want these abortion procedure records because they want to know if this rarely performed procedure is medically necessary, as some doctors are saying. The new law does not make exceptions for the woman's health. But what about the woman? I mean, how concerned should a woman be who needs this procedure?
Well, I think it's a very troubling development. I think this is really a tool of intimidation by the administration, by Ashcroft, to really intimidate women who might be seeking abortions, because it does raise the specter that the government might try to subpoena this information from hospitals. So how this battle is ultimately resolved, I think, is very important. I think it needs to be stated loud and clearly in our laws that when patients go to their doctors, that their information is secure and that it's private.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Solov is Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall Law School in Newark, New Jersey.
The first outbreak of HIV infection among American college students has been uncovered by scientists in North Carolina, who used a new, faster way of testing for the virus. The web of infection encompasses 37 campuses, most of which are in North Carolina. Primarily African-American men were found to have contracted the virus. Some of the students had tested negative for the virus with the older, slower test. Joining us on the line from San Francisco is Dr. Peter Leone, lead investigator of the study and medical director of North Carolina's Sexually Transmitted Disease Program. Thanks for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you.
Tell us what you discovered.
What we found was a rather dramatic increase in cases of HIV newly diagnosed in college students beginning about the middle of 2001. 87% of the 84 cases were in African-American men. What was interesting about this was that we're talking about students who don't necessarily identify into traditional high-risk groups. And as a result, we think that a lot of them really grossly underestimated their own risk of HIV acquisition.
What do you make of the fact that 87% of them are African Americans, if anything?
Our country is still very polarized based on race. So black men have sex with black women and other black men, generally speaking, especially in the South. It's a very small pool of students. If HIV enters into that sexual network, it can rapidly take off.
Doctor, so many years of so many warnings about the perils of unsafe sexual behavior, and yet this outbreak, is there going to be, do you think, a chilling effect on that kind of behavior, certainly among these 37 colleges where the outbreak has been discovered?
Well, you would have thought, given this is a generation that grew up in an era of HIV, that we shouldn't have to talk about the risk. Obviously, we have not been effective in delivering the message. Now, I think we need to talk about risk reduction, you know, abstinence, reducing the number of partners, use of condoms if you're having sex. But I also think we have to step back and realize that what we've been saying and how we've been delivering the message has not been effective in reaching the population at greatest risk. We have a lot more work to do to understand what we need to do to convey an effective message. It's not being done. We hope it gets some attention, but the problem is we also need resources to be able to do that. And frankly, I think that black men in our society have been very marginalized to begin with at the societal level. We need resources. We've been dealing with this for almost a year, and we've gotten no additional resources from the federal level to deal with this problem in North Carolina and, for that matter, in the southeastern U.S.
And again, what you're suggesting is that North Carolina has looked at this problem more aggressively than other places. There's no reason to think that such an outbreak among college students couldn't happen anywhere else in the United States.
That's right. And when we look at our sexual network of schools that are involved with this, as I mentioned, seven of the schools are in five other states in the southeastern U.S., and we also have the District of Columbia mentioned in this. And then we looked at our college students compared to non-college students with HIV. These students were statistically more likely to travel to Atlanta and D.C. to meet partners. So we really are concerned about spread within the whole area of the southeastern U.S. There's also no reason to believe that this wouldn't have an impact in other parts of the country. I mean, our window of looking at this population is a 2 to 4 year window. So the students who we haven't diagnosed HIV in are graduating and going back to their hometown or taking jobs in other parts of the country, not necessarily aware that they're HIV infected. So the potential of this in terms of transmission to a vulnerable population is enormous.
Doctor, just to finish up, what's the reaction been on these campuses?
Well, we've had a tremendous response from the student health services as well as from the campus as a whole. But we haven't seen is this upswelling of interest and support from the student body. And that's what it's going to take. The students have to take ownership over this problem. I'm hoping getting the message out will do that.
We've been joined by Dr. Peter Leone. He's medical director of North Carolina's Sexually Transmitted Disease Program and the lead author of an important new study on HIV infections among college students. Dr. Leone, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a retired colonel says American troops are spread too thin.
And later in the show, two of the many sides in the debate over gay marriage.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The commander of the U.S. Armed Forces in the Middle East, General John Abizaid, came under attack in Fallujah, Iraq today. The general was unhurt and brushed off the attack, saying, "This is Fallujah. What do you expect?" Well, today's attack places an exclamation point on the end of a violent week in Iraq. Joining us from Baghdad is Kristen Gillespie. She's a correspondent for CBS Radio. Kristen, first of all, I know there are conflicting reports coming out of Fallujah, but what are you hearing, if anything, about the attack today on General Abizaid?
What we can confirm is that a vehicle pulled up as Abizaid's convoy was going into the Iraq Civil Defense Base near Fallujah. They fired on his convoy with rocket-propelled grenades, and there was also gunfire. U.S. troops responded firing on the attackers, but they got away. Hmm. There are no U.S. casualties reported, though. Hmm.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that story, but this week has had a huge death toll for ordinary Iraqis. Deadly suicide bombings, as you well know, on both Monday and Tuesday that killed at least 100. You visited the site of yesterday's bombing?
I did. I arrived about an hour after the bomb went off, and We got to the site. There was a crater outside the Iraqi Army headquarters. It was about 6 feet long and 3 feet deep. Now, the site was fortified, the headquarters, so the inside was protected. It was the people who were outside waiting in line to get a job that were unfortunately killed. There were about 50 Iraqis killed.
What is the thinking there? Are these attacks thought to be related to the CD-ROM that was captured and said to contain memos from al-Qaeda operative Zarqawi to his al-Qaeda superior saying, you know, there's a window of opportunity to beat the Americans and it's closing before the elections? Is there thinking that that these attacks are in response to that?
The 17-page letter that was found is what U.S. officials call a blueprint for terror. It basically outlines how to start a civil war in Iraq, and it says that the grip around them is tightening, and they can feel it. So they're going to step up attacks in the period before the Americans are scheduled to hand over power to the Iraqis at the end of June. And this is why we're seeing such a drastic increase in violence lately.
Well, the L.A. Times is reporting today that Colin Powell, in testimony yesterday, signaled that there might be a delay in handing over power to the Iraqis. What's your sense there on the ground in Baghdad?
U.S. officials here in Baghdad are emphasizing that the terrorists want to delay the handover of power to the Iraqis, and this is the goal of the whole insurgency, and that they are not going to respond to terror and be blackmailed by terror. So they are insisting that the handover will go ahead on June 30th.
What about Iraqis? What are they saying, especially after this horrendous week?
They feel there is a distinction that the coalition forces make between the value of Iraqi lives and the value of American lives. And they feel that if 50 Americans were killed in a car bomb on one day, much less on 2 days, we would see immediate changes on the ground in terms of security.
Kristen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Kristen Gillespie, correspondent for CBS Radio. She spoke to us from Baghdad.
Soldiers of the 101st Airborne returning from Iraq already know the day they'll be flying back for their next tour of duty. Many before they've even felt the hugs of their families for the first time in a long time. Welcome to the new U.S. Army, according to an article in the March issue of Army Magazine. Bob Killebrew is a retired Army colonel. He's taught strategy at the Army's War College, and he joins us now from Newport News, Virginia. Welcome, Colonel.
Good afternoon.
Colonel, back home, a soldier, with a date to leave again already on the calendar. How unusual is that for a man or woman in the Army?
Well, in the Army of today, it's unusual, but it's rapidly getting to be the norm. I might add, the 101st won't go back for a year or more, so they've got time. But it looks like for the Army for the foreseeable future, and for a good portion of the reserve force as well, it's going to be a rotation to Iraq or Afghanistan or some other garden spot similar to that about every 18 months to 2 years now.
And this is a fundamental change from what armies usually do, which is to fight and retrain, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a lot more retraining than fighting usually, right?
Well, that's correct. My daddy was a career soldier also, and he said that a war just tears the hell out of the regular Army. And they have to come back, retrain, reequip, and plan for the next one. We're plainly not in that condition now. Now it's going to be, as far as I can see, a perpetual conflict for the next several years at least.
A perpetual conflict for the next several years at least. Now, the U.S. Army is still the best trained, most lethal army in history, I think you would agree. But what impact does this have on their ability to fight wars, particularly if wars evolve on more than one front?
The consensus, I believe, among most of us people who still follow military affairs is that we are stretched, the United States is stretched, very, very thin right now. We have no reserve at this point. At the present time, I believe the only deployable division in the United States Army is probably the 3rd Division, and it just got back a few months ago.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld 2 weeks ago invoked emergency powers to increase the size of the armed forces by 30,000. How important is that?
It's a welcome step, but it's still a drop in the bucket.
Perpetual war, a system strained. Is there a tipping point? Is there a cracking point?
There probably is. My sense is we're not there yet, but it could crack in two ways. One is if the present level of commitment keeps up for longer I'd say, than another 2 years. The soldiers and the equipment in the Army itself are just going to start wearing out. That becomes a gradual tipping point. The abrupt tipping point will be if we encounter another contingency, another war, or another deployment in the scale of Iraq or Afghanistan, the force will simply not be able to cope. So there's a lot of that. In addition to fighting the war in two places, in Iraq and Afghanistan, we are beginning now to, inside the Army, to reorganize the force. So inside the Army is a combination of Mr. Rumsfeld's transformation and the real world of war. There's this enormous Brownian motion going on right now of units coming back, reorganizing, re-equipping, and getting ready to go again. It's a very busy place.
Retired Army Colonel Bob Killebrew, who's a professor at the Army War College. Colonel Killebrew, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Paris 1968, according to filmmaker Bernardo Bertolucci in his new film. And we'll also speak to an historian about the student strikes that almost toppled a government.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
For a second straight day, the Massachusetts legislature is putting aside its regular business to vote on amending the state constitution to bar same-sex couples from marrying. Yesterday's emotional constitutional convention included tears and pleading from the various sides in the debate, on the floor and in the overflow gallery. The effort to amend the Constitution comes in response to last week's state Supreme Court ruling that the state must offer same-sex marriage and not civil unions to provide equality for gay couples. Well, joining us is Massachusetts Representative Ann Paulson, who represents the town of Belmont and parts of Cambridge. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you very much.
We also want to welcome Representative Thomas O'Brien. He's a state rep from Kingston, Massachusetts.
That's correct, and please call me Tom. I also represent parts of Duxbury, Halifax, Middleborough, Plymouth, and Plimpton.
Okay, well, we'll stake our claim there. Representative Paulson, to you first.
Sure.
There were two proposed constitutional amendments put to the House and Senate yesterday. Mm-hmm. Both define marriage as only between a man and a woman. One authorized civil unions, one suggested civil unions. Mm-hmm. Both were voted down. How did you vote briefly, and why?
I voted no on the first because I felt it really did not provide any protection for people who might seek to have benefits.
And the first, we should say, was the one that suggested that civil unions be considered?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, which authorized civil unions.
The second one authorized civil unions, and although many of us in the House felt it was not an appropriate amendment, we thought it was better than most of the alternatives. And I did vote for it because I thought that that was a better question, if it had to go to the ballot, that would be a better question to be asked.
Would you prefer no amendment at all? Are you for gay marriage?
I would prefer no amendment at all. Mm-hmm. I am very much opposed to putting exclusionary language in our Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Representative O'Brien, Tom, same question to you. How did you vote?
Well, I voted yes for the First Amendment. It included language that suggested legislation that would provide for civil unions. I believe that that was appropriate. It would define marriages between a man and a woman and suggest civil unions. The Second Amendment, which I know you're about to ask me my vote on, I voted against. I agree with Representative Paulson when she said that there were some concerns about the amendment that it may not have been an appropriate amendment. There was language in that amendment that I found very troubling. What I did like about the amendment was that it included civil unions, and I am hopeful that we have an opportunity today to vote on language that will define marriages between a man and a woman, but also give us the opportunity to require civil unions.
There is another amendment that's going to be voted on and debated this afternoon. What does that one state?
Well, I imagine, Robin, that there will be a number of amendments. I think the amendment that you're referring to is the one that I referenced, which defines marriages between a man and a woman, but also requires civil unions be available and that the same benefits, protections, rights, and responsibilities that are afforded to couples under state law are also afforded to same-sex couples who enter into civil unions.
What's the difference, then, between this amendment today and the one yesterday? It seems on a, you know, first blush that it's just the person who's presenting it is the difference.
Well, actually, no, there's a very real difference. The one that was presented yesterday articulated in a whole host of paragraphs exactly what would be required. There was a lengthy attempt to articulate the various benefits that would be covered. I'm concerned about all of that language being proposed and included into the Constitution. I would much rather simply have something that says civil unions shall be provided.
And just a quick comment from you on today's amendments.
Yes, this amendment that will be before us today is really a repetition of an amendment that came up first, and that is the Finneran Amendment. And my sense is it is not in order. And furthermore, it indicates, and very clearly in the language, that the General Court shall enact such laws as it shall deem necessary. And it does not say that we will necessarily have civil unions in Massachusetts. It's a very clever way of providing an out.
Let's move from the amendments to what's happening here in really an historic moment. What has it been like for both of you? I want to start with you, Representative O'Brien, first. This has been an extraordinary display of democracy, really, with everyone speaking their hearts as well as their minds. What's it been like for you to watch this?
Well, it certainly has been historic to be involved in this debate. I have been up here now for 8 years and have been involved in many contentious debates. What I will tell you, Robin, that I'm most impressed with is the decorum exhibited by both sides of the debate. We had literally thousands of people up here yesterday, very caring, very passionate, caring very deeply about these issues, and they have points of view that are opposite of each other. And yet everyone, to a person, behaved in a manner that I think was somewhat unexpected, given the feelings and the sensitivities that revolve around these issues. I can tell you, too, that in the chamber as we were debating these issues, the members of the general public that were seated in the gallery spent 6 hours riveted to the debate. Democracy has been on display here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's been on display not only for this country but for the world to watch, and we should be very proud of ourselves.
And your thoughts, and compare it to, you know, past tense moments.
Right. I think that this is an issue of greater significance than any other issue that I have participated in my 12 years. The death penalties have been very emotional debates, but this, of course, has historic perspectives that are far beyond that, and I believe, you know, speak to an issue that is not only in Massachusetts, but in the country and the world. And for that reason, it is a historic moment. Yeah. We're very busy trying to make sure that, first, we are heard, second, that the processes are taking place in an appropriate way, and also that we are obviously trying to win our position.
It seems, too, and just a quick thought, that this is one of the most powerful illustrations of when the politics is personal.
It is personal, but, you know, as in any debate, not only is it personal, but it is also a look to see what happens to generations in the future. I went to the post office yesterday, and the man behind the counter said, when you vote, remember, Rep, that you are voting not only for today and not only for you and your family, but also for all the other families and for all the future families. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a very good point. We also hope that our constituents and the people in Massachusetts and in the country understand how difficult these issues are for ordinary people who have been elected to represent their districts, and that we are really struggling to do our best.
Mm-hmm. Representative O'Brien, one last quick question. When is this over? How long does this go on?
Robin, if I had those prediction skills, I would go into weather forecasting and make a lot more money. I think that many of us are looking to come to resolution, but at the same point in time, we do not want in any way, shape, or form to limit the debate, making sure that all of our colleagues have an opportunity to express their opinions.
Will the legislature keep going until there's an amendment that everyone likes, or is there a chance that, you know, those who want a constitutional amendment may at some point have to just give up on it if they keep being voted down?
Well, there's always that possibility. My sense, however, is that there are a number of amendments that we still have to consider. So I'm not sure we could predict exactly when this is over. And I think even when we're done here in the House, if we have a proposed amendment, it goes to the next legislative session where all of these issues will be reviewed and debated again before it were to go to the ballot till 2006. So you might candidly assess that this isn't over until 2006 and beyond.
Mm. I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Massachusetts Representatives Ann Paulson and Thomas O'Brien speaking to us from the State House.
Still to come, an artist and a statistician have found there's art in chat rooms.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It was not of immediate interest to put this together. So said Michael Eisner, CEO of the Walt Disney Company, reacting to a $54 billion hostile takeover bid by Comcast Corporation. Eisner's statement would certainly seem to qualify as the understatement of the week, given that he's widely believed to absolutely hate the idea of entertainment giant Disney being absorbed by the considerably smaller cable system company, Comcast. A merger between the two companies would create the largest media company in the world. But where does Comcast get off making such an audacious move on one of the most famous corporations in the world? To explain, we're joined on the line now by Wall Street Journal reporter Peter Grant. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Peter, first of all, how does this work? Can any company able to write a big enough check take over any other company?
Well, if it's a public company, the answer is yes. The people who run the companies have a responsibility to their shareholders. And if someone comes in and offers them a huge premium to what the stock is trading at, their responsibility is to take a look at it. And if they think the best deal for their shareholders is to take that offer, they are required to do so.
So if Disney's shareholders ultimately say, sorry, Michael Eisner, it looks like a good deal to us, that's the deal can be done.
That's correct. But keep in mind that the shareholders, to a great extent, a lot of them listen to Eisner. He himself has a lot of shares. He controls a lot of shares. Mm. He controls a lot of members of the board. So it's not quite that easy, especially if the buyer doesn't want to pay a ridiculously huge premium that'll cause them to go bankrupt in the end.
Hmm. Well, Peter, tell us about Comcast and tell us about their origins, it turns out, in Little Tupelo, Mississippi.
Well, way back in the early 60s, Ralph Roberts, someone who was in the garment business, decided that the business wasn't working out for him, so he bought a cable system in Tupelo, Mississippi. He started with one cable system, and it slowly began adding to that, and it got bigger and bigger, and especially in the last 10, 15 years when there was a huge consolidation wave in the cable industry, he got bigger and bigger. And most recently, in 2002, Comcast bought what was then the biggest cable company in the country, AT&T Broadband. They bought that and became the largest cable company in the country.
Now, some of the timing of this was interesting, wasn't it, Peter? Comcast CEO Brian Roberts, who you just mentioned, announced the offer on the same day that a Philadelphia Federal Court of Appeals held a hearing on new FCC media ownership policies. Why would he time it this way?
Well, I think the timing might have partly had to do with that, but I think what it primarily had to do with a lot of the upheaval going on at Disney right now. Comcast is nothing if it's not opportunistic. In the past, they've timed these types of hostile offers for when their prey has been weak, and that's certainly the case with Disney right now.
Just very briefly, Peter, what do you think are the chances that this will go through?
A lot of it sort of depends on what happens over the next few weeks on the defense that Disney mounts. Disney is not very well positioned to mount a strong defense, partly because Disney has never adopted some of the measures that other companies have had for just this kind of contingency. So in that sense, Comcast has a fighting chance. Their bid that they made yesterday was considered by many on Wall Street to be low, so they're going to probably have to put a lot more money on the table for it to succeed. But I think that Comcast does have a compelling argument to make for the Disney shareholders and the directors who are unhappy with Eisner. They can point out that by combining Comcast's 21 million subscribers, its cable pipes, its broadband pipes, you combine that with Disney's content, and you have an opportunity to make a lot of money.
Peter Grant, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Peter, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Internet is ubiquitous these days. People use it for research, to book travel, to connect with other people. But just how big is the Internet? Who's out there? And what are they talking about? Well, millions of people worldwide send more than 3 billion email messages a day. Hundreds of thousands of people chat online, typing as fast as they can in tens of thousands of different forums. It's a giant conversation, an overwhelming tide of data. But an art show opening today in Cambridge, Massachusetts, aims to transform this Internet chat into something on an understandable human scale. The project is a collaboration between an artist and a statistician, and here in our producer Alan Cockle visited the Listening Post.
Can we get a party started?
I'm Ben Rubin. I'm an artist. I work a lot with sound.
The critical mass is approaching. I can almost hear it.
Well, my name is Mark Kanson. I'm a statistician at UCLA.
The critical mass is approaching. I can almost hear it.
It's an impulse I think I've had since I was a kid. You know, going to sleep late at night, listening to shortwave radios and CB radios and trying to hear what people are talking about out there.
There must be some.
What we're trying to do, in a sense, is to try to find different ways of capturing or listening to the buzz of what people are talking about out there. You know, what are they talking about right now online? It's work that draws on thousands of chat rooms, bulletin boards, and other online places where people exchange messages, and it draws all that text into this one physical place and creates a kind of sonic and visual arrangement of it.
Here we have this big rumbling data set that we've collected that's kind of ragged and a little unstructured and trying to find what the patterns are, what things keep emerging, if there is anything.
When you walk in the room, you see a curved curtain, a little more than 20 feet long, that's hanging in the room. And this curtain is formed out of 11 rows and 21 columns of these small screens, and they display text. And the voices and sounds that you hear from the piece are coming from all around you.
The piece is divided into six scenes. Talk about how those scenes are created. What are they?
Well, the scenes are structured to represent different aspects of the data. Some of them are very simple and just try to convey kind of the magnitude of conversation. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there.
Rain, innuendo, perky, Clinton, clan, comparing affected shops.
One of the other anchor scenes tries to build a map on the bank of screens that roughly organizes posts into different topics.
Did he actually fail to take the exam? Or did he just flat out fail the exam?
So something about the election may grow up in one place, and something just, you know, general day-to-day conversations may grow up in another part of this map.
Chinese supply the VC. Be specific, which promises do you think he cannot deliver on?
The design of it is to try to give you a real sense of what people are talking about. And if there are pieces about Iraq or there are pieces about, you know, Bush's presidency or something, those contributions just naturally cluster on the screen and it grows. And each time the scene plays, just depending on what content has happened in the last few minutes, it's different.
Are you there?
Others try to kind of render it in a little more human way.
I am. I am.
So the scene that is kind of a litany of the I am, the I am sequence is trying to more show a personal side to things.
I'm 15. I'm okay.
It turns out Mark discovered that one of the very most common ways to begin a posting in a chat room or a bulletin board is with the words I am. So that began as a statistical discovery, but then when we sort of lined up all those I ams one after another, they became a kind of poetry.
I am doing okay.
What is this? What does it tell us about where we're at or who we are now?
I'm not good enough.
It's a mix of things. It's as varied as people are. And so at times it's funny, it's silly, it's sometimes it's very poignant. And some things, I think, read as poignant that weren't necessarily typed that way. You might have this isolated fragment of a conversation where someone says, I am so lost. That sounds like, oh, that really gets you.
I'm lonely and sad too.
But it could have been typed in a, you know, technical help forum or something. So
I'm missing like three tracks.
So there's something about it where when you take these things out of context, and that's what this whole piece really is doing. It's a big decontextualization machine. You know, everything is pulled out of its original context. And when you do that, what happens in part is that, for me anyway, I tend to project around the fragments that I hear.
I'm not nice.
You know, I tend to imagine what was the conversation that this came out of.
I am behaving like a dang it.
It summons your imagination to try to make sense of it, because it doesn't make sense. The things didn't originally connect together. So I think it's a natural human impulse to try to make a story out of it.
I'm 20. Anyone want to talk? I'm getting tired of Muslims. I am allergic to hugs. I'm about to lose hope. I am from Germany. I'm back. I'm a USA boy. I am good, and you? I'm a lab assistant. I am not too much for tags. I am 18, any girl out there? I'm a hermit Uncle Sugar. I'm doing good. I am in the Blue Mountains.
The Listening Post by Ben Rubin and Mark Hansen is one of six multimedia projects opening today at the List Visual Arts Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For dates elsewhere around the country, along with images and video of the show, visit our website, here-now.org.
And this final note, we've received a lot of listener response to our continuing coverage of the Massachusetts gay marriage issue. For example, Scott Metcalf of Watertown, Massachusetts, called into our listener line.
I am a straight man who's been married for 10 years, and I feel extremely strongly that this is one of the best things that could possibly happen in Massachusetts and in the United States. This is a civil rights issue. And until we extend civil rights to every human being in this civil society, we're neither a humane nor a civil place.
What do you think? We'd love to hear your thoughts on this important issue or on any other issues you might be thinking about. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Grudel, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our intern, Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.